morning, and this my presentation will build perfectly off of the AIM presentation, whereas they established the importance and the need for this among our programs. I'm going to kind of go into how a little some of the science and reality in the field support the need for some additional recommendations. I'd first like to acknowledge a couple of my staff who participated in this, our nurse consultant Sandra Jo Hammer and one of our field representatives Steve Antine, and many of our other field evaluators also contributed some of the photos you might be seeing here. And my hypothesis is that this is really an important area that we are not putting enough emphasis on, and we're not really aligning the available science with our current recommendations. We really don't know the scope of this problem. This quote by Lance was from a recent national news article. We know from research, and any of you who go out into the fields, the VFC program, know how common it is to find temperature violations in the offices. And then we have very spectacular losses that hit the news. And I don't want to single out New Mexico here because we've all had big losses, but this one kind of topped the recent dollar amount. And then major efforts at trying to revaccinate patients. We really need some consistent data collection, not only in our state, but between states. And I hope that that's a role that AIM and CDC can play. But we took one look at it just in the Bay Area. And we found of the various reasons, the most common cause for vaccine loss was actually expired vaccine. But these were usually just small amounts of vaccine. When you looked at the value of the loss, it was some temperature violation in some part of the cold chain spectrum. And when we extrapolated this to our state, it easily topped $2 million. And I suspect that's actually still quite low because we just don't know all the temperature violations. The reason it's becoming a high value item is because of the amount of vaccine that the providers now have in their refrigerators. We consider this a very medium-sized provider, and this was the inventory in their refrigerator that we took out because of a temperature violation. It amounted to $150,000. This is another reason this is happening, because of training of staff and, you know, something as simple as just record the temperature twice a day. Sounds simple, right? But I know you all have seen this in your offices. And these are two different temperature charts. I put a lot on here. But if you look, they dutifully recorded below freezing temperatures day after day on this one, and dutifully recorded the number, 28 to 30 degrees on this one. These were only 1 month each. These went back month after month after month for at least 6 months on both of these clinics. And I don't think this is unusual at all. Now, why do we have our main problem is actually freezing. And what is the problem with freezing? Well, it relates to the aluminum adjuvant. The adjuvant is just a stimulus to help stimulate the immunity of the antigen or raise the immunogenicity of the antigen. And when it's frozen, the adjuvant partially or fully dissociates, decreasing the potency of the vaccine. It does not necessarily damage the antigen itself. And that's an important point. The other point is that these are complex solutes. They don't necessarily freeze at the temperature of water. Most of them freeze below the temperature of water. None of them freeze above the temperature of water. Hepatitis B is considered the most sensitive to freezing, and it freezes at minus 0.5 degrees centigrade. So let's look at our general recommendations and where some of our discrepancies are, and Kelly looked at some of these. The first were recommended that, you know, your basic domestic refrigerator freezer unit is acceptable, not optimal, but acceptable, as long as you don't use the top shelf and some other things. But what providers and many of us don't understand about domestic refrigerators are that they're not even designed to maintain a uniform, stable temperature. They are not designed. They have temperature variations, and They work regardless of whether they have two controls. The way they cool is they take cold air from the freezer, i.e. frozen air, and blow it into the refrigerator compartment. And for that reason, you really have a very limited space of temperature control. This is, looking at this refrigerator here on the left, the empty one, we took that, and with our infrared temperature gun that we use in offices, we looked at the different temperature zones in this refrigerator. As the air came out of the vent from the freezer, it was 29 degrees Fahrenheit. So anything near that vent there is going to freeze which is why you don't put it on the top shelf, although this vent doesn't necessarily have to be on top. Sometimes it's down near the bottom. Then, you, for some reason, look at the temperature range in the four quadrants and notice that on one bottom one, it's below freezing. And there's quite a range. There's a 10-degree temperature range in this refrigerator. Now, if we do it according to how it should be done, shouldn't touch the back wall, the side walls, nothing on the top shelf, nothing on the bottom shelf, you really get about 30% usable space. Temperature, the fridge on the right here shows how it should look in a practice. Now, we could stack a few more rows maybe on top of these, but believe it or not, this looks almost empty. That's $30,000 worth of vaccine and 800 doses. Well, here's what we see when we go into practices. And you're laughing, but I know you all see the exact same thing. And this provider is trying. Look at how well these are labeled and separated. He's got his VSC vaccine separated. This is the reality. And there's somewhere in here is a thermometer, probably somewhere in here. But I guarantee you that there is frozen vaccine or a vaccine exposed to freezing temperatures in this refrigerator. And this is the norm. So if we have developed a tool with our quality improvement team in California that both looks at the inventory in a practice, and it's an Excel spreadsheet that converts that into a dollar value, because we think it's very important that providers know the dollar value in their refrigerator. I guarantee you they don't know it. Not only that, but then it calculates if you have a regular domestic refrigerator, what size do you really need in terms of usable space? And you can see, except for this large practice on the bottom that basically has a walk-in fridge, none of the practices have nearly the size that they actually need, the optimal size, to store the amount of vaccine that they have in their refrigerator. And that's expected in a domestic refrigerator. So then we're told we shouldn't use dormitory-style refrigerators, but there's no further description of what a dormitory-style refrigerator is, and because they're not, but ironically, we can use them during the day, but not during the night. So vaccines aren't supposed to freeze during the day, or it's assumed that they wouldn't put enough in there. But here's the nightmare. This is what we don't want to see in a dormitory-style refrigerator, but I know you've all seen this too, because you have the freezer unit on top and all the vaccines, you know, I guess these are supposed to be frozen up in there, but the rest, these are going to be just as frozen, and that vaccine is packed to the brim. So this is the classic dorm style, but really, you know, what about just under-counter refrigerators? We're, you know, the general recommendations do say that we do that it's preferable to have a freestanding or independent refrigerator and freezer, single purpose, but they still are hesitant to recommend medical specialty equipment. Well, here's a nice example. This was a medical specialty under-counter refrigerator. Okay? You could, maybe some people call it dorm style, but it was sold as medical specialty, did not have a freezer unit in it. The other irony is this was sold by McKesson. Little conflict of interest there, don't you think? I mean, this isn't, now granted, these aren't, this is the same company, but different arms. They sold this to one of our major health plans who bought about a dozen of these at $900 each. Then they found that they had these exposed coils in the back that not only froze the vaccine up against it, but constantly dripped down and ruined the other vaccine under it. These were totally unusable, and they do not have them in service now. So why aren't we saying what is acceptable, not don't use a dorm-style refrigerator? We need more specification. No exposed coils. Under-counter is fine. General recommendations then say, and you've seen this quote, that we are responsible for determining the viability of vaccine. Okay, so we've all seen it, 32 degrees. What do you do? Is it frozen or is it not frozen? In fact, unfortunately, the New Mexico loss, I understand, I might be wrong, was 32 degrees. And there was no attempt to evaluate the viability of that vaccine. Now, it seems like there should be a test, some way to do it. The World Health Organization has a precipitation kind of test that they use, but that may not be accurate enough for our needs. But we need better, because when you go to the manufacturers, you're getting filtered data. Most of their data they keep is proprietary. They only release the data they use for licensing, and the licensing is not the full spectrum. And so we're not getting the right information from them. And then it's filtered through their legal department that constricts them even more. So you go through them, you just be aware you're going to get the lawyer's interpretation. They're not willing to accept any, you know, questionable risk. But here's where the best data comes from. It's the World Health Organization. It was referred to by Kelly, and it's available online for any of you. This is a table summarizing stability from this document. And what you see is that all of the inactivated adjuvanted vaccines are sensitive to freezing. But what is remarkable here is that they are very temperature stable at room temperature. And yet we have gotten somehow paranoid about keeping them cold, so we always are driving this towards the cold side, and that's why we're getting into such problems. Now, there was also a problem because varicella came in and forced this, everybody in these dual units to crank down their freezer, so of course they started blowing colder air into their fridge and freezing vaccines. But we don't need to keep vaccines as cold as we do because they're stable at room temperature for weeks and months in some cases. So World Health Organization, in recognizing this and ironically finding that even in tropical areas up to 50% of vaccine is being frozen during transport, has now said that you never ship these vaccines with frozen packs. You decondition those packs by letting them melt partially before you put them in. We don't need to be using frozen packs except for vaccines that need to be frozen. And I think this would be valuable in the United States too, because we have all seen that we get freezing during shipments because of this idea that the colder is better. We just lost a ton of flu vaccine when our correctional department shipped a vaccine to a flu outbreak in a prison and put it on dry ice, thinking, well, you know, does it go from 100% to 0% in efficacy? No. What happens when you dissociate the adjuvant is you get a decremental decrease. And these are some of the data pulled out of World Health Organization book there that shows that, you know, it may go down to 80% and then 60% with refreezing, repeated episodes of freezing. But this has important implications for revaccination. In other words, if you have multiple doses of a partially compromised vaccine, not zero potency, but even 50, 60% potency, do you need to repeat three doses? Well, the Australians have looked at that, and we've been doing this for quite some time in California. We say, no, give one additional full potency dose. It's basically like an extra booster. I mean, we have some extra built into our vaccine schedule to begin with. Not all countries vaccinate with the number of doses we do to begin with. So that's just something we need to be looking at in our recommendations. So what am I recommending as a, from this talk? Well, I recommend that we get the groups together that have an interest in this and have expertise, including the immunization projects and the CDC and NVAC and IOM, and get a consensus conference together and see what our data is and arrive at some recommendations that we can live with that are a little more accurate and based on the data. We need to really require or get the manufacturers to give us all the data they have, not just the data they want to use. And we need to fund some stability data. There are labs out there that do this kind of work. They mostly work in the, maybe they work for the manufacturers, but they mostly work in veterinary vaccines, which is a huge area, but same vaccines. There was the country that has done the most with this is Australia, and they had such a consensus conference, and they've put out very good recommendations, which are also online. The other thing is we need to look at our storage units and start to make some defined recommendations, not these vague things that no one knows how to interpret, like, well, a domestic fridge is okay, but you know, we really need to look at the value of the vaccine in there. We need to look at what's on the market, and there is good stuff on the market, and make some recommendations to our providers. They're trying to do it. We should not shy away from purpose-built refrigerators. We may not need a huge scientific refrigerator like this, because that would hold a lot of vaccine. But when you do get a purpose-built refrigerator, not only do they have glass doors where you can see where the vaccine is before you kind of go in, like the ice cream in your supermarket, but you can use all the space. You don't have to have just use only 30% of the space, and it will not freeze those vaccines. We, the California Department of Public Health, we're looking at, we're really starting to develop policies that impose some provider responsibility for both vaccine replacement and for replacing inadequate storage units. We are actually going to come down to specific recommendations, you know, partly descriptive and partly here are some of the things that meet these recommendations. We're also developing online training for a whole host of office vaccine management and administration, including storage and handling. And by next year's NIC, we'll be presenting those, and we may have those available earlier. But these are going to be really state-of-the-art, interactive, online training for office staff. And we're developing the VFC quality improvement tools, two of which I mentioned, which is the calculation of the vaccine value and the optimal refrigerator size. So these, we got to help our providers. They're trying. Here's a provider that's really trying hard, a very organized refrigerator, but breaking a lot of the rules of what he should be doing with a domestic-style refrigerator. This is an example of one of the policies we're working on, and as most of our policies, they're based on the volume of the provider, because go after your high-volume providers, because they're going to have your high-volume losses. And so when we get a high-volume provider, we are requiring them to have refrigerator-freezer-only units, you know, for the value. Remember, they all have at least 200,000 of inventory of vaccine at one time, at any given time. And then, you know, for the smaller providers, we're being a little more flexible, but there are certain things that, if they want to be a VFC provider, certain ones we will not allow. But we definitely make them, require them to replace their unit if they have a loss or if they have a, something that is absolutely taboo. So I just end with the fact that these things are out there. They're available. The food and beverage industry uses these routinely. Every cafe you go into has a drink refrigerator, which is a purpose-built refrigerator that does not freeze those drinks. And those drinks are only worth, what, $100? And we're talking $100,000. The wine industry keeps wine at a very stable temperature, and most of those wine bottles are probably not worth what one dose of HPV vaccine is, or you have a very nice wine collection. And this thing in the middle is a kimchi fermenter, which maintains a perfect temperature of 41 to 43 degrees centigrade to ferment kimchi. Now, I'm not saying we should use this particular unit, but the fact is, kimchi, how much is cabbage worth compared to vaccine? So what I'm saying is, if the food and beverage industry can do it, so can we. And I'd like to see us get together and come out with some concrete recommendations to do that. Thank you.